This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
To really do things that were, in a sense, forbidden by the media people that I was concerned with, forbidden by Olson. In other words, I'd write the poetry that wasn't really allowed by projecting verse, or write the poetry that wasn't really allowed by Denise Levertov's insistence that you really register the life you're in with the media city. And I actually think these people didn't behave this way when I started writing it. They all started picking up on it in a way, and so structure of rhyme had a kind of influence I've never really had with these people before, because, well, of course, they had the same influence Helen Adamant had with me. They also were a little relieved to write some poems that weren't going to be really very seriously make a real obstacle to their imagination. Now, let's take the opening of the structure of rhyme. In structure of rhyme, I even sometimes, and in this opening poem, interfere with words, I rewrite in structure of rhyme at times, because that was forbidden in other poems. I want to make two general remarks. In structure of rhyme number, on page 16, structure of rhyme number 3, uses language in a way that, epithets, glare-eyed challenger, a serpent skin-coated accumulus of my day, uses epithets that are also forbidden in the direct treatment of the thing, of the images. And the one thing about an epithet is it doesn't tend to be operative. As a matter of fact, I don't think it operates in this poem, for instance. It's an address to a snake, but the operation, well, I can't be sure that it doesn't. But still, the idea of an epithet is like those things that Homer uses. And when H.D., for instance, in 1911, was translating for Euripides, she tells an egoist in her first note, when her translations are printed, that she eliminated Euripides' epithets because they were viewed as cliches. Because they were really tough, so that she would not translate in the sense of a she improved Euripides as also they wanted to improve Homer by taking out those swift-footed Diana and so forth. I don't mean that consciously I set out to have an epithet at first, but the permission is so open, and you'll find me in the course of the structure of rhyme beginning to talk about the permission. Now we will go back to that first point. Everything in this book is chronologically arranged, and so that the structure of rhyme happens as it does in relation to poems around it often. And you will find that already by the field, as I have begun to in letters, I was picking up something from previous poems and then going on with them in the next poems I would tend to write, so that there would be a whole series of poems written around a certain theme. As, for instance, The Storm of White is the first intense death poem and the experience, but then later in Underground I'm making propositions and so forth about death, or in the series about maidens women in the field. Mrs. Noah, it follows upon the maiden, but they belong they are the lady of this household sort of thing. Now, the other reason I wanted to start, it seemed to me I knew that this book was going to be composed all the way through when I started it. And then when I got to Black Mountain, I thought, well, I don't want to be caught in one of those things. for one thing, I had a very strong feeling about Pound's never writing any poems other than the cantos. Well, we have a few translations here and there, and he's done more of them recently. That he would take the cantos and that would take over entirely seemed to be a kind of usurping the whole course of a poem and make one massive one. And I more and more felt, I hope you will finish Maximus. Or is that going to be one of those poems, you know, that is going to take so much time that you will never really write a series of long poems, and that there won't be a variety, there's got to be this one thing that will be shaking up all the time with the other poems. Charles writes other poems, but they're not peripheral, but they happen less than they ordinarily would, and none of them can be more than poems of the time they are. They couldn't develop into large forms because every large impulse he has for a poem that brings a lot of themes together goes into the Maximus. Well, so I'm saying about a book, it had a definite end in mind, and I didn't think of it going on forever, but I knew that it was going to take, I really did know that it was going to take 3 years in a very simple way. I wanted 50 poems, and ordinarily I don't write more than 15 poems a year, so I just calculated, all right, I'm going to put the heat on. And there will be 50 poems, but it means that I'm going to have to write more than I ordinarily write, and it couldn't possibly be more than 50. It couldn't be possibly less time than 3 years. And then that made kind of magic, you know, free and so forth. So I've discarded them, the book I'm working on now. I've got to make it 4 years, so it won't be that magical three or anything. So the book will just be a collection. Time enough some other time to return to this sort of thing. But in the middle of that, then, so not only was I escaping from the commandments that are laid down for the modernist, but in structure of rhyme, I was going to escape from the commandments laid down about this book by myself. And so I thought, what I've always wanted was a long poem made up of parts, each one of them discrete, that actually has no reason for having an end or one great big form, because it just means that every time I sit down to write one of the, every time I feel something or get something that I feel belongs to the structure of rhyme, I will write this little thing. And it'll be sort of, then I thought of Zarathustra of Nietzsche, where you're able to have, although it has a sequence, for instance, but the appeal of that to me when I read it was that with those little short sections, each one somehow calling to your mind some aspect of a spiritual world, some crisis of a spiritual world, and making it dramatic. You have a whole series of they don't pile up toward a crisis. You have a whole series of little themes that are permitted, and you can also talk about different things because any character in Zarathustra can come forward and say life is, and that was also forbidden in modern poetry. You're really not supposed to say life is so and so, and although there were poets like Wallace Stevens who were doing it, they were not in the line I was showing the other night, and I have a very strong feeling of the line. I am extremely fond of Wallace Stevens, and actually been enchanted and even intoxicated and carried over to my poetry, but I still do not feel Wallace Stevens is something that I can bring into my feeling of the tradition. So, okay, in structured rhyme, there will even be Wallace Stevens-like things at times, not the cute words, which I find distressing, is wanting to make special little poet language, because the language of this is never special. Anything that looks strange in here is drawn from the traditions of mystics that I was reading, and from the traditions of that I was reading, mainly the Zohar, which has many references to the Jewish commentary on the Old Testament. I ask the unyielding sentence that shows itself forth in the language as I make it. Speak, for I name myself your master. Come to serve. Writing is first to search and obedience. Now, I've got a person, I away, and that was what this poem was possible to be populated with persons. So the sentence is a person, and the sentence was immediately unyielding sentence, and is the sentence of God in a courtroom, the sentence that God made on man, the sentence for something committed that then were meant, I said, because the magic of the medieval scene, I had to expiate until I felt released in taking care of a child in the period. And from a poem, there's a sentence that is, there's a burden of responsibility after any poem that is only finally exhausted when you serve the sentence of that poem. And from the beginning of a poem, from the very opening of a poem, there's a sentence of another kind. At Black Mountain, a little later, because the Law I Love is Major Mover, the poem that just precedes this. I'm not going to read it, but the occasion of writing it was, and you'll see why the sentence came in this way, the occasion was that I had a series of classes in the morning and lectures in the evening, once a week lecture, but two classes in the morning that preceded the once a week lecture, and they were on ideas of form. And the first week of this course, the idea of form in the lecture was Genesis. And I conducted it like a seminar. There were only five students, I told them what the form was, and then one of them presented a paper on Genesis as a form, and the others talked about Genesis as a form, and then I gave my lecture, keeping the game straight, because while I would participate, I would not draw from what they said in the lecture. So the lecture was neutral. I mean, the lecture was just as neutral, let's say, as the paper the student wrote, although it came afterwards. Because I wanted to see what the conjunctions of these things would be. And then the second one was Law. Well, the fellow who wrote the paper on Law was a graduate of a Jesuit college in Boston University, and he had a sort of idea. He was sort of a little James Joyce. And oh boy, he really dug all over the place with his paper on Law. But you see, I was leaving up to them to get these reforms they were talking about. And his paper must have been a beauty, because I understood less of it than I did my talk last night. And then when he was I said, "Well, Joe, have you ever been under a law?" He looked up from his paper. And drew a blank. All of the Encyclopedia of Religion was in his paper, and every reference you could find a law, I was kind of amazed, because, you know, in a week you somehow dug everything and shuffle it in here. I said, "Well, when you start a sentence, you see, I'm giving you keys to what it is that suddenly comes out in its beginning. When you start a sentence, aren't you under a, and with the word the, or the word aren't you under a law from there on for some time, because that word the started something, and until it ends it, you're under a sentence, you have a governor. And if you start a poem, Joe, you're under a law to keep those sounds. Not to have them reoccur, but to keep, you've got to keep all of them so that when they reoccur as part of the form. Or when they don't reoccur, they reoccur as part of the form. So that is one of the things in the sentence. And suddenly then I not use this word sentence, I don't think so, I'm not sure. I probably do in letters here and there, begin to play with the idea of a sentence. But to bring it, now of course the word sentence has gotten to the place where it's just located here, and I would have I haven't had a new sentence for some time, but this is the chart where it was, a law, an inexorable law, one that you couldn't escape from at all, and my problem is going to be syntax then. How did a sentence move, and why is it that in the course of any utterances you write, you seem, if you're responsible in keeping something, you seem to be carrying out a thing over you that must arrive at this form. Now, I don't mean the total form of the poem, and will only disappear when you've carried out the surface sense, and then other things are usable. But, of course, I don't have any time to think all this in any way, and this brought me on. And then the great thing for this forum for me was that I could talk, and then something else would talk back at me, and that's really fun. Now, so it's me that says, in a way, but it's no one is me. It's presumption. It's the poet who says, "Speak, for I name myself your master, who come to serve. Writing is first to search in obedience." So I'm not speaking by myself. I give the structure of rhyme over to the poet. It in turn sometimes to voice is very much me, poet. But in the beginning, this poet speaking is really a poet in the most of, this poet is speaking right out of, in the terms of obedience, master, and service, out of something I've really found in places that weren't poetry, in the Zohar, and in Hasidic stories that I was beginning to read, in which you, in any art, or in their religion, in their relation to the religion, in order to master anything, you had to serve it. This was one of the things they played on, because you had to have a lord over you, the lord over you, before you had freedom, was one of the concepts in the hostage. And that's one of the things that plays here. So that when you're obeying the sentence, you are in the freedom of writing, otherwise you have a writing block. Your writing block is entirely a resistance of the sentence in front of you. Usually what happens is you want to express something instead of following what is being said, what you've begun to say. You begin to say something and then you feel as if, and of all absurdities, to try to express something or want to express something when you're writing, when you have only to follow what you're saying when you write, because your writing is ultimately in such a neutral document that you and anybody else, once it's there on that paper, are in the same relation to it, to read. You don't really care if you've written, and nobody else does, if something of you gets expressed or not. What you read and what in fact is the world that emerges in there. And then, of course, it's okay, so you could call it you expressing, but the block is usually a feeling, oh, I ought to perform in here or something, and you don't go ahead with what it was you started to. You keep thinking it ought to be better, and that was part of what I certainly obedience meant. There is a woman who resembles a sentence, and that's really a challenge. Okay, so you're going to be awfully smart and speak this way, and I will start making some statements about this world of poetry, and I'll make them very recklessly, and you can figure out later what they are. I say to myself, I mean, this is part of the experience as I was writing it. I certainly thought, wow. There is a woman who resembles the sentence. I'm writing fast, so I can't remember who is she, but I'm still asking, who in the world is she? Or what am I trying to do here? Can I really bring in the white goddess I'm thinking? Or maybe a little hot grave stuff? And so I'm also defeating that. And then maybe it's mother. I've already written she has a place in memory that moves language. And okay, all right, so she is mother. Her voice come across the waters from ashore. I don't know, to ashore I know. And then I've already got an other world in here, and it's translated into words belonging to the poem. She's ready to speak. And mother and muse and word may have had their origin in reading Graves' White Goddess. We read White Goddess when it first came out and had a little time in the it's reflected in the Venice poem, had a rather intensive period in which everything was related to it, related to the ideas there. That is that the poet actually serves the moon and serves the lady or the woman, and that all poetry is a present to women. Graves, who was quite extreme, said that it was not possible at all for a man who writes poetry that had anything really to do with men reading it, and had to do so that, of course, the Barragoon ballads and it somehow fall away. That would be, they all read it, and they all read it aloud, but it was all for the ladies, sort of thing, and this tuned into the cult of the Provence, too, that Graves doesn't even bring up. However, all right, I had a kind of thing, and this might be the muse talking to me. And then the poem's really fun, because it really kind of I remember when I was about 10, and I was happily sitting in the bathroom having quiet conversation with myself, and I was visiting an aunt who lives in Aberdeen, Washington, and she said, "If you talk like that, you're going to be a little bit down on Robert." And I quit that talking to myself, but in home, I really do like talking to myself in voices, you know. It wasn't just straight talking to myself, but there's lots of voices. There are a lot of people in the city in that picture bathroom that picture day. And now in a poem, that same thing that children can do of having innumerable companions and a whole family going is guarding your dog. But this is where, by the way, this particular action is, this belongs to childhood, this particular action involves the calling up people. Almost every, I think power is universal as far as I've ever heard. Well, I must give another digression. It's to comfort the people who keep track of things you can all put your mind to rest. One of those fast acts, our poet is very earnest and writes quite responsible poems. And he's wondering at his late 30s why they've never arrived anywhere. And I sometimes wondered about why they didn't, because he's a very nice fellow and he certainly was not showing off or anything. He's quite earnest about poetry. He talks about it quite earnestly. I was at his house and his little girl was playing with a large doll almost her size. And she dropped it and I said, what can I say? But anyway, whatever I said was that was exactly the sense that the doll was alive and when it wouldn't be hurt when it was dropped. And the poet's father turned around, and I certainly saw why he'd never gotten any place in poetry. He said, she really wouldn't think silly things like that. She knows the difference between things that are alive and things that aren't. The little girl really was trying to play her game with the doll, but I almost turned around, except at that point something awfully cold in me said, "Oh, sink your own boat." You can wonder from now on why you have all those troubles writing those little poems. But so one of the secrets I can give away is practice talking to yourself. It's really, and there's one place where it's permitted, and that is when writing poems and play. Although there are people who get disturbed when you talk to yourself in poems. Have heart, the text reads. So I've got a pretend text already. You that were heartless, suffering joy or despair, you will suffer the sentence, a law of words moving, seeking the right period. I saw a snake-like beauty in the living changes of syntax. Wake up, she cried. Jacob wrestled with sleep, you who fall into nothingness and dread sleep. He wrestled with sleep like a man reading a strong sentence. I will not take the actual world for granted, I said. Why not, she replied. Do I not withhold the songs of birds from you? Do I not withhold the penetrations of breath from you? Do I not withhold the weight of mountains from you? Do I not withhold the hearts of men from you? I alone long for your demand. I alone measure your desire. O lasting sentence after sentence I make in your image. In the feet that measure the dance of my cages, I hear toxications of the man I will be. Cheat at this game, she cried. The world is what you are. Stand then so I can see you, a fierce destroyer of images. Will you drive me to madness, only there to know me? Vomiting images in the place belong. So before I was through, I was going to do another thing that my entire... When on the board the other day, I meant to draw the ocean and do a large penis shape because the coast looked something... And I'd already got a little worried about the fact the coastline with that town of Gloucester looked like a slight breast with a nipple. So I undid myself, as they say, with the next thing I was going to draw. In poetry, I'm extremely careful about not having this sort of double image occur. That is, I'm more than wary, and if it even threatens to happen, I use it, and I don't become a victim of Freudian a double image. Well, structure of mind is the department in which you do what horrifies you, and so there it was. Cheat at the game, she cried. The world is what you are. Stand then, though I can see you, first fierce destroyer of images. Will you drive me to madness, only there are no vomiting images into the place of the law? But the for all of the fact that I reckon, now what ordinarily I do in a long poem, for instance, and now there are certain areas of almost any long poem I've written in which this Freudian content is allowed to be developed, and but at the same time, I don't, poetically, I change myself by making the reader quite aware that that content's there. I mean, as I also become aware and consciously shape the passage so that you don't have the uneasiness of what looks like an unconscious content. Well, I'm very aware when I write, so I was not unaware of this Freudian content in this passage, but what I did not do was to supply it with had I been, let's say, composing in that sense, this would have been a long poem, so that this would not have been unresolved in a sense. This is a rather disturbing double image. It distracts from what it's actually saying at the level of things about the poem. So that these things come a little like dreams, the structure rhyme. I kept trying it, and initially, and actually now, too, I would write when I decided, now I will write a structured rhyme sort of thing. And I had full permission to write what I called, in my own mind, what I called sort of badly. That is, I had permission to write a way that I would have a failure if I wanted to in the writing. You people have been reading these structured rhymes. Let's open after I read a poem like this, let's open it to questions for just a minute. And I'll tell you what kind of questions, the kind that you would like me to answer about the specific poem that you actually have a query about meaning or something done in the form. And then I will go on to the next one. And this way we'll key back also to what may be your residue question. You can get some footnotes this way. While when I talk about them, we'll go in whatever direction I want to. So, did any of you have questions that came up from this opening? Not about what I've said now about it, but when you were reading this poem.
Yeah, when we were talking about it earlier, we talked about this one in particular, and we hit up the point where we thought it was the muse that you were talking about when you came to this woman who resembles the sentence.
Mm-hmm.
This is what we thought of. But we connect, the connections I made with this was the Greek concept of muse that connected with music and drama and all the arts. Is this what you're thinking of?
No. The muse in my mind was so tied to grace. When I have the Greek thing in mind, I almost have a lead in from the memory, mnemosyne business, the mother of the muses. And they're referred to as muses, not muses. This muse of poetry is not, as a matter of fact, it isn't mentioned in the muse. It is not Greek. It is Druid in its reference, but it is also another image from the Jewish, I'm sure, from the Shekinah, who is God's glory, let's say, actually. That's one of the meanings. But the other meaning of the Shekinah is that it is. In relation to all the orders below the Shekinah, and it almost appears as a law over them, not just a glory, and it is a large mother figure, a large nurse mother figure, and they combine, well, they do in graves, too. So it's a single muse. It's not one of those muses, not Apollo, the leader of the muses, or the daughters of Mnemosyne. Mm-hmm. No, it wasn't Greek.
I wasn't thinking of it as Greek. I was thinking
of the music.
Grace put them all together.
Oh. Well, no, but that was. But I must hear it seems a single figure, and I'm not sure at all. For instance, also in relation to these structures of rhyme, I often go back to them as text delivered to me in part, and I'm not clear as to what it meant. I feel when it says there is a woman who resembles a sentence, that this is something I was told in the process of writing the poem. Whereas when I say speak, for I name myself your master who come to serve, there I feel that is an assertion on my part, and I don't really wonder why I made it. But the thing said to me And then the things asserted at the level of the story, you see. I mean, it is not my idea that there's a woman, but something, it has told me that there is a woman who resembles the sentence. This is the nature of the world, this structured rhyme. So there, for instance, I myself have never solved, but I return and sometimes, and now my poetry now often has, and the prose I'm writing at the present time often is dealing with nurses and with, and mothers in a sense of like the earth the other day, trying to locate this woman figure, not for instance one specific mother, although there may be some. Certainly, I believe that the place in memory that moves language is, it has to do with the period of childhood before you learn to talk and before you learn what the words meant, and then you're surrounded by an ocean of the talk of all the adult world around you. And you know its inner meanings. Children respond to the inner meanings of what their parents are saying because they hear the tones, and they hear, for instance, parents are working up toward a quarrel and they don't know they're working up toward a quarrel, and they think they're talking about something and having a disagreement, or they're working up toward a neurotic scene and they don't know that's what they're doing as they're talking. It's going to take place later. But the children have no way of following this line of discourse that the parents are distracted by. The children hear the tone. And so all of a sudden the child will begin to cry when people just really get done talk about something else. And this is a thing you've come across frequently in reading. I've read extensively in psychoanalysis and also in Piaget all the theories about the way children feel and the level before they understand language. Because this level of the poem, of course, the funny thing that happens in a poem is that this level is intensified. And we as adults really have a very hard time keeping track. If a poem's read aloud to you, for instance, it's almost impossible to follow the content because the very thing a poem does is to raise it to such a musical threshold that you are restored to the state you were in as a child of not understanding the words and feelings and emotional ambience. And the poet writing it actually is I talk a great deal about cerebrations and recognitions, but in a way it's because I have to have my mind occupied in this in order to have the real thing in the poem happen, which is this other under ambience. And that's why, for instance, I feel these things being said to me, let's say they come from the unconscious, I'm not quite sure they come from.
Does this tonal meaning that you were talking about yesterday then work on this level?
Yes, because you can recognize it you can recognize I have to reach one of these where there's tone meaning involved. This one doesn't immediately show it. If I come to a passage where I can demonstrate tone leading and vowels, maybe I'll find a poem where I know it is, and then I can show you what that tone leading meant. But that is one of the ways of beginning the movement of the music. But it's also a way of the conscious mind participating in it. I just meant the feeling that many people complain, of course, right away. I couldn't understand the poem. I wish it had been read once or twice or three times or something. Well, the poet also doesn't understand what the level of the poem as heard is. And if you've heard poems in a foreign language that you don't understand, of course, you're immediately sent with a tonal fact, but a language fact, not a music fact. There's a great deal of difference between any sensation of music and, let's say, hearing something in Hindustan and poetry. So where we got off on that was just that I felt that the woman resembled the sentence and that had a place in memory that moves language. It is something about the origins of one's being in language before you understood it at all. Dante says that the vulgare eloquentia is the language your nurse spoke. Now he means the language of the breast, because the women in his class in Italy didn't nurse there. The point of the mother not nursing the child, the child is nursed by a wet nurse. And so he did not say the language my mother spoke, he says the language my nurse spoke. And this is what the language of people is. I mean, that we with the observation that only somebody in the upper classes of Italy of the Renaissance would make. So that you really think of it as that the milk that you got was identified in some way with the language. But more than that, of course, the really important thing, well, I say the really important thing because my mother died when I was born and I was raised on a bottle in a hospital. I would be like Ellen Thomas, flat on the floor, if I had gone back to the original nurse for my sensation of language, as some people do. But what I picture it as is an ambience of language in which you live, like womb of language, in which you understood nothing but what was known by it, and that might have been a sensation you'd have in a hospital, with voices coming and going and so forth. Or in the household. I was in a household for a while, but I did not have an emergency one, so how do I remember it?
Robert, is this structure of rhyme, or and the others too, is there the effect that here that you're trying to bring out your own poetic? Is there any of that?
At certain times, I really am trying to pretend that there's a poetic. In a different way than when I lecture on it here, an inaccessible poetic that will be revealed to me step by step every time I return to structured rhyme. Sometimes I can't quite figure out what it is, but that is what returning to writing the structured rhyme means to me. It can mean anything, many other things, but in the beginning I really did feel, also of course, since I can speak in it, you see, I'm not having revealed my poetic to me, but saying it when I make this business about master and serving. I can also speak within this structure, and so it isn't always going to be a revelation that way. Now this related, you all had that letter, a mimeograph, in which I wrote to Warren where the phrase structure of rhyme came from. It came from the other class I had at Black Mountain. Was a class in elementary technique and beginners of techniques in poetry, and I had from another workshop that I had in San Francisco developed this idea of a structure of rhyme, developed this from reading Schoenberg on the 12 tone system and some other people trying to get understand what this implied, because I began to see that we also worked with a tonal system with a set of vowels. And then dealing with vowel sounds, not letters, and then the minute I started investigating those vowel sounds, discovering the role consonants have, but it did give then, instead of the old picture, which I was opposed to, of course, along the line of convention about rhyme, I looked up what rhyme meant, and it was part of the ratios. It was one of the ratios or measures within the poem. Well, I already knew in music you can have different measures. You can change tempo, and you can change a tonal scale, and you can make all sorts of changes in measure within one composition and have it be a whole. And, you know, as a matter of fact, now in San Francisco they play things where different parts of the total orchestra are playing on different scales, different tempos. And even a conductor, if you're conducting two different tempos at the same time, it's quite a sight. For one part of the orchestra that is playing in one time structure, and another part of the orchestra that's playing an entirely different time structure. With in the background an electronic tape, which is, it doesn't have to be conducted, shifting structures all the way through. Well, of course, this is way ahead of the time when I'm working on this book, but I did know in this book that you really did not have to keep that major ratios could be shifted and within a work of art. That's part of the modern thing. And then also, of course, in the beginning of the workshop, I used to just have to say, well, see, you know, the rhyme is not really that the words sound alike, that they literally have the last syllable. It's really something more important than that. But then what did that remark made? I had to get at it, and you've seen that chart where I began to... and the other thing was the students in the workshop, people writing poems, were having impressions that certain things rhymed with certain other things where there weren't any sounds like it present. And the way they put it, well, they'd say it rhymed, and then they'd say, well, isn't that sound like that? You know, doesn't the rug really sort of sound like moose? They really would always be longer words.
Well, at first I wanted to fight against this impressionism because I knew that they weren't, you're not paying attention to sound. But I suddenly realized that if you just remove this sort of, because it's always sort of self-indulgent, but if you just remove this and began to listen to the rug and the moose, you've got two sounds, and here you're bringing them together, and once you really are thinking of them as interacting, it is a very secretive poem. It's a secret of a rhyme structure as much as things sounding alike. And so I substituted for that business and trying to put at the end of every line, not that I was doing it, but I meant as even a concept of rhyme, words that would sound alike in their last syllable. I substituted keeping the sounds of the poem and a goal that can't be entirely reached, in which that the conscious mind is aiming all the time at a point at which it could keep all the sounds of the poem. This means that it's aware all the way through the poem of the entire accumulation of sounds, so it is never operating without knowing what the reverberations are. Now, you know, for instance, Warren has a book here on telling, for freshman classes, I guess, or something, about what poetry is and about techniques of poetry or something, has a little section that I almost fell off my rocker, they say, or my high chair. It was a section on rhyme, and it explains inner rhyme, and it uses a line from Poe where actually what had happened is that you were rhyming on every stress, and the inner rhymes are exactly like short rhymes, only Poe would put them together, so you have one of those false long lines that's really three beats, and the two go together to make a six-beat line, and you always rhyme on the third beat, and this professor was calling this an inner rhyme. Well, it was monstrously offensive because he was thinking it's in the middle of this conventional line. But the great, Marion Moore is already, and Edith Sitwell too, had traced the long feeling of vowels in a poem, and that was what led to making a big structure of rhyme. Now that structure of rhyme, once I made it, also came along with reading about the 12-tone system, and was beginning to hear some music that was going outside the realm of the 12-tone system, where you were bringing other sounds into the musical composition, began to go together with something else I was reading with in these sources of visions of the world. And that was a dream of what a harmony meant. Now Plato thinks of harmony as being everything brought into a very restricted order, and you eliminate disorders and disharmonies. But there was another vision that there was a great scale of the actual created universe. And when you could keep all the parts of that great scale as being related, then everything was in harmony, because you would last have an inclusive scale. And then all the searches for these scales in music could be pictured as searches of human tolerance to bring, and actually you can't tolerate an endless scale, but the scale seems now to exceed any point it was before. But even with all these numbers of scales, there are still possibilities of sounds intruding that don't belong to composition. And once the sound's in the composition, it has tone, and where it has tone, it belongs to some imaginary scale that now no longer resembles the notes on the piano, because much of the music is why they change notes on the piano to arrive at it, and why they introduce other sounds in order to arrive at it. Well, now, what did that mean in poetry, I asked, really, because it was exciting to me in music. I'm not a musician, it was not just a theory, this music was exciting to me. What was exciting to me? And I began to see that, in poetry, we tend to have a scale of images that we can use. Now, how do we extend that? It is really our sense of the harmonious that can enter into a poem. And we bring discordant things in because we mean to form a large work, an oeuvre, in which those things that originally looked like discords will finally appear, maybe, at the end of your life, you put supplied something that makes that awful, that thing that seemed most awful when it was in a poem someplace, you suddenly brought it into scale, and then someone sees it as harmonious, and they say, well, how did you know way back then that this was what it is, you know, I mean, look how calculating that 12-year-old poet was. Way back then he had the shape is in what the total earth is. No, but no, you begin to keep. And one of the structures of rhyme is an example of that keeping. You know, I skip ahead to it. Skip ahead to how I lead into it, because it comes up to a poem that belongs to Grace. It's the one that in the first poem at 9:1.
Where does keeping the rhyme come?
Oh, well, that's a little rhyme that I thought of while I was walking around the street. It comes as well. I thought, oh, goody, I'm not going to have that. But yes, keeping the rhyme is on page 51. That really, I was walking along and the stoplight stopped me long enough that one of two poems I made up in my head before I wrote it down. Happily went along the street deciding it and somehow didn't get hit by everybody or run into everybody and wrote it down as soon as I get something ready to sit down and write it down. That's by stress and syllable, by change, rhyme, and contour, we let the long line take even awkward to its period. The short line, we refine, keep for cast. Well, you see, actually, the real role of end lines is when you don't have any, you know, you're not writing it down, so you can't have, and you're really kind of dumb, so you've got to keep these rhymes to keep them going while you're walking along the street to remember where you are. This we remember, ember of the fire, catches the word if we but hear, we must understand what has happened, and springs to desire a bird right like sound. This is the Yule moth that warms December. This is new grass that springs from ground. Oh. See that quote in there, we must understand what is happening, in parentheses and so forth, and quotes. This is something I didn't have to reach to a book to revise. In 1948, while I was in the process of writing the Venice poem, Ezra Pound sent out a few poets. It happened, and he sent it to Creevy, I didn't know Creevy at that time. A new little set of instructions, but they were free, just as in that images thing. And the first one was watch the duration of syllables. Now, this is true. The first one, the third one was. And the tone leading a vowel. Yes, it's four, actually. I see what it is that happened. These were numbered. And this one was really our major proposition of that little poem. We must understand what is happening. And they're introduced into the text on the very day they arrived. They were introduced as part of the orchestration of the Venice poem. They were a dome, they came on a little postcard, sketched out with a master's hand, and the third one was then the function of poetry. Is to debunk my lucidity. Well, this really became a kind of absolute thing for me from there on. It had already been there, because one of the things before I received that little postcard, I'd had the sense in the medieval scenes that I knew what was happening. But I wasn't able always to do what was required in the poem. But this undermined something. I already felt strongly as a law in poem. And the keeping of the sound, you see, the ultimate of knowing what is happening in a poem is that your conscious mind, this is a law that has to do, it doesn't have to do with writing good poems. There have been some of the highest poetry has been written by poets who do not know what is happening. This has to do with the permission for the consciousness to operate in the poem. Now, our period is terrifically conscious and we think all the time about how the unconscious operates in a poem. And we have full permission in a way for the unconscious. We think that all of all the strange and wonderful things come from the unconscious. Well, our whole Freudian psychological focus gives us this sense. Now, and many artists can only operate on an unconscious level, because what makes an artist has nothing to do. It has to do with intelligence, and intelligence is not the same as consciousness. Intelligence is not our brain. Intelligence is in our fingertips. Intelligence is in the coordination of the brain. It has to do with living ability. And living ability is paramount in the unconsciousness. Consciousness is an entire adventure in itself, an adventure that we undertake in our living ability. And some people who have quite a development of consciousness don't have much living ability. They have disorganizations in this. Now, so the real thing that stands for is that the poet gives permission for his consciousness to enjoy the writing of certain areas of the poem. And then more than that, he aimed, and I had to decide, by the time I was writing this book, I had to decide I would permit myself to, permit my brain to enjoy, all the coordinated faculties of the brain, permit them to enjoy the poem, just as you permit your senses to enjoy poem. As a matter of fact, I had to break down some idea that that there was some kind of activity of the brain that isn't poetic, or there was some kind of activity that, and all of these were things of certain organs. Once it dawned on me, that brain sitting up there, that's an organ. It's part of your glandular system. It's internal, we know, but yes, it's got full permission to be in a poem. It can enjoy itself if it wants to. You can write a passage that doesn't seem to be all emotions, because it is motion. I mean, you certainly must be familiar with people who feel that if anybody starts thinking a poem, that something's changed and it's no longer part of their whole person and no longer really emotionally valuable. So that's what knowing what is happening means, is this kind of awareness. And then I do have, as one of my ideals, in my own world of the poem, that one could finally become, or that you might reach, or that the consciousness must be as full as everything else. The consciousness must be as full as the senses. And the consciousness must be as full as the unconscious. And many of these things, when I said I didn't know where that other thing came from, it would have been easy to say that woman came from the unconscious, except that my conscious mind is always exploring, and it also picks up things. And it also picks up a picture of the world, and it also there was also a consciousness in this beginning, and its little rudiments begin to play as much as the unconscious. Now let's get to the one that I was looking for, and that is on 72 and 73, the structure of rhyme 10. Now that I think when I read and talked in Lauren's class winter, I spoke about the prohibition that was in back of this. That is, we met in different phases. There are almost always groups in San Francisco meeting, reading poems, reading their poems, and criticizing them. And these are very intensive sessions. As a matter of fact, they sometimes threaten to take over entirely one's life. That is, when you are expected not, you think these 3 evenings are exhausting. But when you are expected every week to have at least 3 of your 7 evenings taken up with current reading, then if you're missing, if you do not go to one, it means that you have made some decision about the poet who's reading. and so the politeness comes into it or something, and finally you go, damn, I'm not ever going to go to any kind of poetry reading unless I already like this stuff, and I never heard this, so I'm not going. And I've reached that plenty of times. If you really heard poetry because you're sick of it, that takes a lot of time, or it takes only a little short time. In one of these sessions where we've really been going at it and we're coming near to where we couldn't stand it again because we're meeting every week or twice a week it was, that they were beginning to criticize more and more. They'd heard most of the opening appeal from the time I'd come back to San Francisco, and they were criticizing more and more Duncan, you're getting kind of, I think you're getting kind of playful and nothing's really going on here. These are not real things that you've gotten as structured rhymes. So, all right, you told me they could, I'll just And so I got where the has the sound of tree and the has the sound of nut, which was just exactly what they were hoping wouldn't happen. And I can do it just what you said I shouldn't do. The everlasting is the first thing, for the sea is the, and clover reminds me of ever. The learning is in re, and in turning forms a ring to reach the word the, abounding faith for the sound restored. Cabinet kings, call your castles. The children build up in the sand, renewed fortresses to stand for an hour, to keep delight has in hopeless causeway. For Galahad, a boy's mind, rides to his lady. The waves rush in and defeat their tower. It melts in the undertow. Later we see flowers falling from the wet bough gathered into the skirts of another lady, who stands up into the trembling colors of puberty, sheathed in a cloth of painted buds. Salmon, pearl white, rose blush of nacre, her colors flung. For the blue wash of sound drawn back to its shores, a shell appears, is rolled under, comes up again, the ash hell shadows, melts and divides into ash and shell, from which the grave black tides of hell receive. The sound returns from the shell that is death fears, the wave roll. Children fall from the limbs of the ash, pearl into gray, O bloody castle that is world free, our flesh melts in the thorns of your cross, dust comes to your knees. There are memories everywhere then. Now, tone meeting, or what it is that happens in rhyme. One of the rules in the structure of rhyme, once I discovered it was what I was doing, I had to make it a rule over myself, is that even if they come one after another, I've got to block out in my mind any conscious reference, my wanting to use, hide for myself what it is that happened in the preceding line of the let's say, between. Here's what I read, before I even reached it. Our dust comes to your knees. Now I have to make an autonomous start of the new one and not really know, in order to enjoy it, I mean, because I know it's going to happen. There are memories everywhere then. That is, the true rhyme between knees and memories. They're in two entirely different poems. But I discovered when I started writing, I knew I should not go back and look at the previous structures of rhyme when I was going to write a new one. It had to be new, and it had to come as if it were all alone. But you see, there was quite a gap between Glalie, I am the rose, and then it was almost a year before the next structure of rhyme. And I think it was there that I noticed, I can't remember, but I think the rhyme was there. Next is an impossible tear flows, yes. It was when, after a year, and not going back in my mind at all, certainly not when I found I was going to write structure again, looking at Glalie, I found this, I am the rose, is the concluding line, page 20. I am the rose is the concluding line, turning there won't do any more than verify. And then if you look at page 70, I'm a year ahead, and I have really, there are all those poems in between, so my reference must have been somewhere. It really gave me quite a kick. From the nexus and the impossible, a tear flows, served grief in the universe. So I end rhyme when the thing is so removed that it is really comes as a pleasure instead of some sort of obviously. But the minute I recognized it and it was there, then I knew I had to hide from myself when I started to structure rhyme what it had been at the end. So I really had to block that out deliberately of consciousness. In other words, for consciousness to enjoy it, at certain points you really do want to get the kick out of the fact that you're this is not the same as the Freudian unconscious. This is the unconscious motor system, or the part that is not cerebrating or designing because we've got the damn Freudian unconscious when I'm talking about the unconscious organizations of nerves. It actually does operate in language. It operates in those little patterns whereby, for instance, there are doctors who can listen to my speech and know what my heart is like and my lungs and make a diagnosis. Because not only does my speech reflect lots of other things, and like the Freudians, as the Freudians know, my speech reflects deep psychological patterns, but my speech also, and yours too, and your handwriting, about the absolute scale of resemblance and disresemblance. Well, that scale of resemblance and disresemblance is that I wanted to avoid the word rhyme and restore it to a sense of ratio, a measure. And so I call that structure of rhyme when I have a workshop the scale of resemblances and disresemblances, in which you recognize that while you're keeping the sounds of the poem, some of them resembled each other and some of them came to extremes of not resembling each other. Let's say, of the percussive sounds of the poem, that dip and tip are very closely resemble each other. And so they're described in charts, systematic charts of linguistics, they're described as in one order. Well, they have an important difference, that one's voiced and one's not voiced. So they have a disresemblance. But you can come to total, tip are not really, you'll hear a vowel all the time. But you see, once you key into the resemblance, disresemblance thing, and then the absolute scale meant that with that pyramid form that I was sort of showing in the letter, where you had a total rhyme, which was a pun, and useful in the poem, though, seriously, as a double, not only the double meaning, but the possibility of having the one word perform a role in two different melodies. Just as you can have one note that really belongs to one line, and the same note belongs to another line in the music, and has a double role, although it only has two sounds in this one place, because you've got one melody that it belongs to. Because if you have counterpoint, you see. But at the level of images through a poem, for instance, you do have such counterpoints, and the pun can operate in two different sets of images, one of which is maybe terminating and the other beginning, and the one word has a dual operation. And so on content, yes, it's got a disresemblance, but I'm thinking of sound, so that I think, I don't know what word I use, I probably played light and inversion tile and so forth, but I think of sun, let's say the word sun, you haven't got an inverse, simple inversion of the consonant. But sun means not only the sun in the sun in the heaven, but sun, S-O-N, and they come together actually God that's the sun, and that is also the sun. So it is a disturbing. It's a pun, for instance, that doesn't have much of a dual action, because the minute they come to that level, they're already established in lore as one. Now that's an absolute resemblance. Sun and sun, they're the same sound, same word. And there are languages that work on this extensively. A Japanese evidently has so many puns that this becomes extremely important in their prose writing, particularly, and in poetry. And that is why the haiku is designed so that they will not repeat vowels at all. That's the trick of the haiku, is to go through a real tone row of five vowels before you're permitted to have the vowels again. And then this is a way of limiting the reoccurrence of puns, because they evidently have such a high, with only five vowels, you're going to have a very high portion of puns, and with a language that has very few, that doesn't have many monosyllables. I mean, it has many more monosyllables than we have, like in this country. A language with many more monosyllables than we have, and with much fewer vowels, you're going to have a high proportion of puns. And so, therefore, it works extensively with this. This is why it's hard to translate haiku, and why we get the weird thing when people write haiku in English, in America. Yes, it's gives you a certain sense, but then when you really read people doing a text, and when you suddenly realize from all the footnotes that isn't what the Japanese do, they were playing a complex web of but of doing little patterns, and all based upon the fact of the absolute resemblance of the pun. Then in between, of course, are all the partial resemblances, where the vowels seem related, or the vowel changes it, but the percussive elements, the shaping elements around it are similar, all the way out to where none of the sounds in one word appeared in the other, and then this is the area of the
system. But I'm not an absolute scale there. This is
Oh, well, of course, how you do it is still my own question.
Well, I can see how you have the absolute scale of resemblance, because if you get less than that 5 and you got no likeness, then it seems there's no connection.
Oh, but no likeness is a very definite connection. It's as recognizable as the likeness. You have to have a scale. Things have to believe in the same, belong to the same order before either resemblance or disresemblance becomes significant. You couldn't hear a discord unless you have a scale. Discords are manufactured by scale, and in the total harmonic scale, you have a disappearance of resemblance and disresemblance. Sure, but this is that one that I'm talking about that is inconceivable, that is dreamed of. And in every other human condition, or any human condition, let's say, because it almost exceeds the order, and it's a mystic belief that there's an absolute scale, that there's a total scale. And every other absolute scale, there are resemblances and disresemblances that they can disappear. One part of it is, of course, you can find a scale in which some of the things you think aren't similar could suddenly be seen to be similar. Now remember, though, that, for instance, the announcement things that the lion and the zodiac is saying to me, the lion and the zodiac is even more removed from what I understand about Ford, because the star is talking to me, for one thing. And there is an interesting little footnote to this about stars. When I was about 10 years old or 9 years old, my parents made a trip to Los Angeles, and they stopped at a lion farm. And I guess I was 9 or my sister's age or so. And we got photographed sitting on the MGM lion that is the lion that is in the front of all those MGM movies. And he was a nice old three-bitten lion. I don't have too much of a memory of him, but I actually did sit on a live lion and put my hand in a live lion's mouth and have a very personal meeting with a lion, so to speak, when I was 9 years old. And it means a lot when you're 9 years old. And more than that, a lion would have been a star. He had been at the beginning of every movie you saw, and he belonged to that realm. But, I mean, these are real... all right, so it's a series of puns, but...
What this amounts to is that from any one sound, you get a realization of the related sound possibilities. Is that true now?
Yes, and then there's another thing. If you can't connect things any other way, sometimes you connect them by sound. If they don't look alike, then they just sound alike.
But does it give you, what I'm wondering is, does it then give you the related series of words is that the way it works? From sound to sound, that you each time you have the available words because you have available sounds, is that not it?
Well, it must be it to some degree, let's say that the level at which there are patterns of sound in my poetry, and the level of hearing and waiting for a sound to reoccur, but the choice of it, but there is no experience of choosing a word that's the sound. There's only a resource in words that have that sound, because in between writing poems I analyze extensively and recognize everywhere I possibly can likenesses and unlike things that are done in sound. Now, between that first reading of Robert Browning when I was in high school, it is only this last year when in a series of lectures I read Forgella aloud, whole passages, because I was finding things in there, and then started reading a book, which I had never read before, that I recognized how complex. Now, it's not exactly what we call felicitous and harmonious and so forth, but how complex the sound. As a matter of fact, I have not yet broken down, but I was hearing relationships through Robert Browning's poetry that were more subtle than I could analyze. Now, when I meet that, I didn't go to work and try to find it. It's business pending to try to find what it is I thought I heard, or I have to disappear. So, but if you find it, your hearing finally is so located that it becomes a resource, and it always has for you. You don't find a trick, because if it's a trick, you can throw it off. You can find something you could just lift as a given. But if you find how it is that something has happened that you heard,
in a passage of poetry, analyzing it through, then you do find that it will, that something like it is an absolute resource when you come to write, because in a way it gets blended at some coordinated level between your ear and your hand. The whole thing of poetry at this level is that your writing hand is connected with your ear. And that seems to be oh, by the way, one of the things to really think about, you know that passage in Olson where he talks about head and heart, is now all your resources of your writing. I do not type, by the way, and Olson types his poems. I don't know, I really, the typing on a typewriter interferes, really seriously interferes with my sense of movement in a poem and also with my being able to hear. On the other hand, I'm not bothered by people talking in the same room. I'm not bothered by radios playing. I'm not bothered by anything else going on. But I am bothered by myself typing and making things hard noise. But so that I write in the pen. That hand, I really feel that I hear with my hand and hear later with my ear. That my hand is coordinated, and then I have read. In Allport is a very good anthology to read, by the way, on the psychology of perception. It's a whole anthology of all the experiments. It brings you sort of up to, at least as I remember it, sort of up to 1958 or so, on the current laboratory knowledge they have about our functions and perception. They do know that, in a sense, the hand really does hear. Because the connections, in other words, they can make, you can make direct, almost direct nerve connections between hand and ear that seem to bypass the brain practically. I mean, the thing is that the hand, or let's say the hand can hear before the ear does, because that's what it is. It doesn't bypass the brain, but instead of the sound, the ear gets the sound waves. All right, ordinarily when you hear then, it goes to the brain reinterprets it as hearing, and so you hear in a sense, ear sense. But there are disorders in which people hear light waves instead of hearing sound waves, and see sound waves. And there are times blindness and times deafness, which are really that the ear and the eye up here the wrong way. But now, the actual operation of hearing is in some motion that goes like this. It locates where this fence came in. You see, you've got two things that happen. You've got a receptor, and it goes to the brain, but you've got another nerve system that locates that it came in here. And that locate can be down here. Not the receptor. Your nerves here aren't receiving sound, but receiving them out there. But your nerves here are registering as if, and so the sound sense starts here, and you hear it later in the ear. But your eye is operating in this little circuit. The eye sees, the information goes in a circuit like this, and so the hand really is wrecked. Because I've often puzzled about why it is I write extremely rapidly, and sometimes I hear lines automatically. That is, I'm not even writing yet, and a line comes and it's completely formed. And like I said about when she asked me about keeping the line, that was a poem. That walking along the street, I made up and heard in my head and let go until I practically have played it out and then wrote it down already, completely. But that's very telling because most of my operation is notation. And then I hear it after, just a second it seems to me, after I observe the sound by hearing it and playing it over like you're playing poker in my head as I go along. And almost it seems to me that my actual hearing apparatus is in this operation of keeping, hearing while I'm writing ahead what it is that's been back there. Try thinking through, you'll find out at least how wonderful the apparatus of your body is, what it is, what the coordinations are. Do you hear it first and write it? Are there times when you write it and hear it later? What is the eye doing while it's playing? Well, what is it that cooperates in the dance? Well, now, look, by the way, I want to talk one by one other thing. This lion, then, and a messenger in the guise of a lion, is like the woman in the other one, although by the time he's the lion in the zodiac, I'm certainly thinking about that. That's not a received thing. And the lion has been so much there. For instance, the messenger lion idea is in the first poem in that the parts in this anthology, the one about the border guard and the lion, and the, where lion is a pun for a line of poetry, so the line of poetry can roar, so forth, so that there's a funny kind of play in it. But it has it always has a very strong reference back, well, and I'm sure that it must be the lion and the fascination of lions in movies anyway. But the proposition of that absolute scale of resemblance and disresemblance establishes majors that are music in the actual world means that in the absolute, that there's an absolute that has to do with the majors that so we find them, and that those majors are music, not the ones we, you know, they're not the majors that people usually think are majors, the majors of a rule, the other kind of scale, with, you know, inch and yard rule. Regular measures. And it refers to the stars, for instance. All through here, as it is in the past, the actual stars moving are music in the real world. The lion is talking a cryptic kind of talk, and the lion here, I didn't ever think of that as being, I thought of this lion as doing a powerful lot of moving things back and forth about actual and real. I don't think he's entirely to be trusted. He's not like there is a woman who resembles the sentence, which is something in poem with him. This here lion, a real tricky boy.
We made a connection between this lion and the lion you mentioned in the back of the Allen anthology. That is, and because the children are here, that.
So, what is it I said in
there? Take a look at it. I think it's 405.
This is note 52 notes.
Yeah.
The notes of 1953.
Four or five
is still that structure. On lions. The Christians thought of the lion as Christ the King, because the lion is terrible power. That's his bestiary, his evil bestiary. For me, the lion is the child. And better than like the note that his nobility now begins to shoot the dog with that the human mind expects itself with. What is the human desire to humiliate even its own being? For me, the lion is sexual appetite that knows no contradiction within itself. Well, this is me thinking along. I really think that this is being more a person of the poem, this lion.
And where you say, what's the, for instance, the humiliation thing?
Yeah.
We got a connection between why does man retract this?
Oh, I see, yes. And as a matter of fact, this is one of the things the lion says that I found most haughty and actually have tried various times to you'll find another poem in here about there's another poem in this thing, I think, where I've got another version of that. Because really what it meant to retract your song from the air was I think that line that he says about retracting the song from the car is there, seems to me right now possibly to mean that in order for this thing to come, that let's say, why is it that poetry is not music? At times it seems to me that I write poetry because I have been barred from the world of music. And in dreams, in certain earlier periods of my life, in a period when I was in the army and had to march and so forth, really deadly routine periods, when you begin to dream in order to find some part of life that really furnishes anything, because all the rest of it is a terrible routine, I would dream of playing music, of improvising music. And the music is my drink and tie. I don't make poems in dreams at all. And at one time, for instance, there is a feeling that poetry is a retraction from music itself. And in that case, the air is the A-Y-R-E or whatever of the when the poem and the song are together, the air is the song is kind of canopy in order. errors and flaws, and it has become impoverished in the form and separated from its meaning. And so why did he retract this? You see, why did he retract his song into poetry from the air that is now impoverished from the moon point? Now at the present time, for instance, I feel I'm ready to go back and learn an instrument, and that may refresh, that may make some change in my, I really do feel the need of some quickening, it's an immediacy, we begin to form habits. And go back to what I can't do and begin to try to make a poetry that will fit that primitive of thing, to learn an instrument and bring the two together again. And so even if I can only pick five notes, you may hear me crooning over to five notes in some sort of impoverished air. But the lion here is kind of telling me, all right, why do you really? Why have you never gone ahead with this compulsive thing? So I made a fun of you when you were six and you had a terrible voice and they said, why did you want to? Now, Robert, you just be quiet and just hear this lovely voice. And or if you really, this is a fine family thing, but Robert, won't you please just listen to everybody else and sing a home sweet home? Possibly. However, this lion is saying, come off it, boy. Why do you sit around here performing all these poems when you really ought to just be doing your impoverished characters? In fact, which you ought to do. Might be. However, up to now, I've been doing that in very mystical lines, retracting his poems and impoverished there. I haven't created this particular little line. But see, this is tricky because everybody's in a guise of something, and if I'm in a guise of a lion, obviously there's a sort of a follow-up about the dear messenger in this section. That one I did catch on to, and I knew there's something off, and then there's a lion that's out of this guy, and he said he was saying the charm of beast with balls of tongue.
You may be interested in our connection with this. That we connected this with the whole idea of the anarchic, that charming beasts is the wrong thing to do because beasts and children are anarchic, so you wouldn't want to charm.
But do you remember who allowed the first charm the beast? At the very beginning of poetry, there came out of the north of Greece a shaman by the name of Orpheus, and we are told by in Greek sources that he brought to Greek homosexuality and a song and this Vatic kind of song that charmed and fascinated them, trees, animals, and so forth. And from childhood, I've always thought, well, I didn't just sing so good. I always could get so self-fascinated that everybody was like this, you know, that when I would start going in some kind of spiel, in those days, we'd make a horror tale until everybody gets screaming and people interfere, and the girl turned pale by saying that away. But my writing somehow wasn't made available to these children and part of the other fascinating. But back to the false of tongue and the business of charming. Charm is part of is really one of the core of what a poem is. And Shakespeare is uneasy about it. Prospero, when he gives up his magic, which in a sense is his falseness, and emerges at the end of the play, he says, no, I want charms to enchant, and
my charm is in all of the
my charm, I want what? I want something.
I want words.
I want words to enchant my charm. And that is the point at which, instead of turning to God for grace, you find out that Shakespeare's concept was that you had grace from this thing. He turns to the people of the audience, but they're actually, of course, the people of the language. The grace in the at least in the Shakespeare's term, the grace is in the language itself, in the fact that you just make it up in the first place, but you brought charms over it, and it itself is a kind of piece of this is already getting a little, these are things that aren't, I'm sure, in structure of rhyme, so that when I talk about them, I'm erasing the possibility that they're occurring. Because the structure of rhyme is always some peripheral reference to language that opens up the suggestibility out of which other things can come. And so when I close it, when I see something actual in it, you know, like saying this means so-and-so, I just closed off that possibility from returning a structure of rhyme, unless it does it in, well, of course, it thinks it's always a disobedience of laws, it can return, and it does sometimes. For instance, did they read, or did you read to them, the step that I sent you where all of a sudden it says, Kundry is Wagner's creation, or whatever? That late set of classes?
No.
Well, at times, for instance, the structure rhymes, but when I began to observe, I was trying to make a law about not really pinning these things down, trying to keep them always so they were just suggestive. Once I saw that, and something in me said, oh, you can't do so-and-so, immediately I did it. And that was simply to say, well, who Kundry was, instead of leaving her as a person of the poem, saying, she's Wagner's creation, and then just have a little bit that made it actually just Wagner's Kundry. And immediately I just made it again suggestive instead of a reader. So, and then I saw that just doing that made it suggestive because the reader thought he spotted her as unmanned by the time you say she was Wagner's creation and you realize that I've got Wagner inside the poem too. They're gone. Now, what questions? Let's go back to questions about this poem that I go on about. What other questions coming up in this?
If you go back to that resemblance and disresemblance, suppose you take is there any analogy with the musical instrument, with the piano? Could you make an analogy with the piano? Is it possible to do it?
No, I don't think I could, except for the fact that we feel a disresemblance when we the thing that's comparable to a disresemblance on the piano is dependent upon scale, and that is when we hear a discord. Now people trying to break down the it isn't.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just thinking that if you change scale, you don't have discord any longer. You observe the tonal relationship. So you see, absolute is the word in there I don't understand at all, and that's the word that then becomes most strong in that whole poem. And for instance, Mal Rome has a book which has been great influence in my life. One of the volumes is called The Twilight of the Absolute. And something, now you see, so the absolute is one of these real things that the men have always been concerned with, and the absolute is the thing that I find, it's one of those things I can't quite get into my scale of things. So here I propose in the poem an absolute scale of this resemblance and this resemblance, when I keep wanting to move things around and not have them absolute. That's why the thing says that there are music in the actual world. There's an absolute world as well as a real one. Is what this is trying to say. All right, so you know nothing about it, and I mean, so I know nothing about it, and so I actually have I'm not at home at all in the absolute. I'm kind of at home in something I call the real, and I'm kind of at home in something I call the actual, but when I come to this word absolute, my mind is sort of lost, but there it is, a whole realm of human experience called the absolute. And it's meant to be in the poem. So when you asked me the question about the sentence, what is an absolute scale? Except it was insisting, here I am, and all right, if you can't cope with me, if you can't get to the place where you're going to have to remember what idea that left. Yes, last time I was trying to explain to you how James said the duty of the philosopher was to handle all these kinds of aspects of realities, and one of them is going to be an absolute reality. The one you can't, the real of the absolute. And because he won't discard, see, James won't discard from his mind that any of these things human beings, actually, the record, the same one that I was saying you shouldn't erase because it is a record of something. All of them to James are intuitions of something. All of them are the only one of those means that we have of knowing what other people experience or knowing and forming community of human experience. And yet we're always fighting against some element of it because it doesn't suit us or we can't cope with it. Well, of course, it is a good thing to live within your limits and you can be able to have a very happy artist if you don't go spending all the time to try to have the absolute when you don't really feel and you don't really can't cope with it, and then you realize that you're not going to undertake this business of trying to keep everything.
What about that line which seems central, that is, there is a melody within a certain speech that is most man.
Oh, when you're charming beast, it said, or when you're when you're charming the beast, the melody that's charming, there is still man. You sing the melody that charms the beast, but that doesn't mean you're in the beast world.
But I mean, as in relation to a poetic, isn't this close to a kind of poetic? That is, the whole idea of melody, of song, of music,
mm-hmm.
that there is a melody in things.
Oh, I see, yeah, because I have extensively done, and I had at this time, I do have a feeling that the secret of the whole thing is the melody. Yeah, you're true. And in this case, of course, most man then becomes identified with everything. Yeah. This makes it a correspondence, the charm of the melody. Oh, I just did notice one thing. The unyielding sense of the initial proposition is probably like the absolute scale. The unyielding is another thing there. I rebellious, that sort of thing would have a hold over me, something that wouldn't yield. I mean, something that's inexorable law. And so I was fascinated, and I began to try to see it in there.
I can't leave it that way. Well, let's take a musical sense. Mm-hmm. Any given tone question involves any number of tones.
Mm-hmm.
And in all these tones, there's no disresemblance. We can't take it as a disresemblance in tones within a tone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we can take tones from every tone cluster and include them in the other tone cluster. And there's no disresemblance. Now, why must there be a disresemblance? And in the actual tones of our speech, why must there
Well, in fact, here we're talking about resemblances and disresemblances that are the music of the things in the world. Let's say, because this extends in the terms of the actual world, so it's talking about the actual world, that the resemblance and disresemblance, which was my scale of rhymes, meant that everything rhymed in the world. So although you think that a chair is not like a man, or although we're taught that a rock is not alive, if you look at it really, of course you find that there's a resemblance, because you come down to a study of the structure itself, and the mineral structure is periodic, and the living structure is aperiodic, and so Schrodinger proposes that they have a fundamental disresemblance, these two orders. But I'm asserting over that there must be that there are both resemblances and disresemblances, and that this whole thing is a music. Now science proposes that absolute structure, or and also that the human mind, the thing they call choice, is a structure. No and yes, that is something like resemblance and disresemblance. Now your point is part of what you're going to find all the way through the structure of rhyme. You wouldn't have to take your tone roll, because I got some of these structured rhyme things from this.